The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher and other podcast platforms. You can find us there. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. We've also spent a little time talking about publishing in a world without live book events and how to keep creativity flowing when it might be a little harder to focus these days. Somehow, over the course of her many highly acclaimed novels, I've missed talking to Sue Miller, and I'm finally getting a chance to rectify that gap this morning. Sue Miller is recognized internationally for her elegant and sharply realistic accounts of contemporary family. Her books have been widely translated and published in 22 countries around the world. The Good Mother, the first of her 12 novels, was a New York Times bestseller. Subsequent novels include three Book of the Month main selections, Family Pictures, While I Was Gone, and The Senator's Wife. She's also the author of the memoir, The Story of My Father. Her numerous honors include a Guggenheim Fellowship and a Radcliffe Institute Fellowship. She was on the board of Penn American Center for 4 years, was the chair of Penn New England. She has taught fiction at, among other places, Amherst, Tufts, Boston University, Smith College, and MIT. Monogamy is the novel we are talking about today. It's published by Harper. It will drive much of our discussion this morning. Sue, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So you've been publishing since the 1980s, and I just have to imagine that this year must take the cake for the kind of the weirdest time period to be releasing a novel.
Well, actually, my books have sort of preceded disaster after disaster, Oklahoma City and 9/11. I mean, I sort of feel that I brought this pandemic on us all by writing yet another book. I mean, so it is very weird, but I've had other weird ones. This is most profoundly weird, I think, this business of staying home all the time and the sense of sort of generalized anxiety about being out and about in any way. So it's very strange.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, because you're kind of the queen of domestic fiction, and in some ways, I feel like this is kind of the perfect time to be focused on domestic fiction, when not only are we stuck at home for the most part, but we're stuck at home with family. And I think it's, you know, it's an interesting really, time to assess our marriages and our children and our adult children. So in some ways, I always think it's kind of interesting to talk about, you know, where a book is coming into and the time period it's coming into. But I feel like, you know, we're kind of living through all these really interesting power dynamics and reliance on other people that come into play. And so, you know, if nothing else, I can't wait to see what this period of time yields in your next book, because
yeah,
talk about domestic
in fiction. I think it may be very strange and maybe very interesting, or maybe it'll just go by, but I can't believe it won't be addressed in a lot of people's work.
So I'm going to give you a chance to take us into monogamy. I feel like, you know, you're going to do a better job than I will. So kind of take us into this world with Annie and Graham and kind of set the stage, and we can dive into it.
The title is maybe not entirely unironic, but it's, as most of my books are, I think it primarily is concerned with characters and trying to make the characters seem very real to you, the reader. So they are Graham, who's sort of a big bear-like man. He's a bookseller. He's passionate about books. He's passionate about music. He's passionate about parties. He's passionate about his wife and women generally. Sort of a larger-than-life figure and a funny man. And Annie is almost the opposite, I would say. She's a lot more reserved. She's very small as compared to Graham. They actually went to a party once as Santa and one of his elves. And she's a photographer. And she's about to have her, and as the book begins, she's about to have her first show in a number of years. And she's full of anxiety about what her future is going to be as a professional photographer. So we meet them and we have some time with both of them. And then Graham dies of a heart attack in the night. And it's not giving away very much to say that. It happens fairly early on in the book. But he's present after that as you sort of encounter the other people in his life and their feelings about his death. So as Annie first starts calling around, she calls their daughter, Graham and her daughter, whose name is Sarah and who lives on the West Coast doing NPR stuff. And she calls Frida, Graham's first wife, who's very important in the novel, who's, per Graham's wishes, has always been very much a friend of both of theirs, Annie's and Graham's. And then Frida actually calls her son with Graham, whose name is Lucas, who works in publishing in New York. He has a French wife. And during the course of the book, they have a child. So there's also Claire, a child who never knows Graham, but she gets a few lines of dialogue. So the book is really concerned with the aftermath of this death, sort of the meaning of Graham's life to everyone around him. And then Annie discovers shortly after his death, a couple of months actually, that he has, he's been having an affair with someone. And we as readers, because the narrative moves around amongst the characters, so sometimes it's with Graham, sometimes it's with each of the others, but we as readers, because we have sat right on Graham's shoulder for part of it, know that he's almost instantly regretted this affair and has been trying to extricate himself from it just before he dies, actually. So her grief is enormously complicated, needless to say, by that discovery. And by her just feelings of betrayal, her feelings that she's completely unsure of what the marriage actually meant and what it consisted of, her feelings over the last 30 years toward him. And it's really her working towards some sort of resolution of those feelings with all the other characters surrounding her that take up the rest of the book. And that's it.
That was a remarkable description. Thank you. That
it was long.
Better than I could have done. No. So what was the original idea for you? What was that kernel that took you into it, that question that you wanted to answer for yourself?
It really had to do with a book that I wrote about my father, a memoir of his slow dying of Alzheimer's disease. And I was the person most directly in charge of him. My siblings are scattered all over the country, so one person had to do it. And it was me for the last 3 years of his life. And my father was a very shy, but very wise and very gentle and lovely person. He was a church historian and an ordained minister. And so the irony of an historian losing his memory of his own history was very present in my thinking about it. But I had discovered over the course of time, the time writing the book, and it took me a long time, I kept stopping and turning back to fiction, which I felt so much more comfortable with. Mm-hmm. But by the end of the book, of the writing of it, 10 years later, I felt I had come to understand him in a very different way. And my whole sense of him had changed, and therefore my sense of myself in connection with him had also changed. And I wanted to somehow deal with this fictionally in a novel with other characters. So that was the impulse, was to have a character that turned out to be Annie, who had about six other names before I settled on that one, but to have a character feel as though she's been in direct communication with someone whom she's lost, and in some ways has had a kind of revelation on account of that. So that was it. I knew that was where I was headed. And I slowly began to assemble my cast of characters.
Did the finished product, would you say, surprise you from where you started out? Like, did the book become something that you kind of didn't anticipate?
Well, there were many things that became part of it that I hadn't anticipated before I started. Just the children and that kind of thing. But I ended up where I had wanted to go. And I do that unfashionably for a writer of fiction. I don't let my characters take me where they want to go. I remember going to a Grace Paley reading a long time ago, and someone stood up from the audience here in Cambridge and accused her of being anti-Zionist because she has a character who basically says the Jews are meant to wander the world. They're not meant to have a home, so forth and so on. And Grace Paley just said, well, that wasn't me. That was my employee. And she really argued that, you know, she's not her characters, that her characters do what she wants them to do. And that's the way I feel about my characters, that they, I'm in charge of them, and they, the book does what I want the book to do. They don't get into being in charge of the book. I just feel that I want all of the book to sort of partake of the meaning that I'm aiming for at the end. And if I didn't know where I was going, I'd have a whole lot more revision to do than I usually have to do. I do a lot of revising, but it's not on sort of getting to where I want to go. It's enriching things. I think of it as being like, you know, doing a sketch and then slowly filling in more and more details around the sketch, so that when I'm writing a scene, I'll often just stop and say, he'll say something about this, she'll say something about that, and move on if I want to just keep going, and not stop to do it exactly that way. But I slowly go back and fill in and fill in and fill in things to make it richer, is the way I think of it, to make it realer to the reader, I hope.
Right. So wait, before you start, do you have kind of a pretty good roadmap? I guess an outline is what I'm trying to say, but do you take a ton of notes before you even sit down to write?
Yes, I have a lot of notes, and I actually stop all along the way. I write in longhand in notebooks for the first draft, and then, you know, I type it in and print it out and write all over that to do the revision. So there's a lot of longhand stuff, but the rough draft, the first draft is as much note as it is actual making scenes, as much notes about different characters. I'll just stop in the middle of writing a scene if something occurs to me and write it down in, not in the prose that's going to occur in the book, but just to tell myself what I want to do, what this has suggested to me, or something like that. So it's a very odd first draft, is I suppose what I'm saying, that it includes notes to myself and then the odd shopping list, you know, for groceries or something like that, which also might occur to me as I'm working, which is a bad sign, I suppose, but that is what those notebooks are full of, these odd momentary turning away, but notes, not lots and lots of notes. And if I ever get stuck, I just go back and make some more notes and try to range freely mentally over what it is I'm trying to do. And I feel that there's a way in which the kind of notes and the sort of writing I do in longhand feels very provisional to me, and that makes me feel much freer in doing that kind of writing. Not like typing something in. I mean, when you type something in, it looks the way a book looks, essentially, with the typeface. And somehow writing in ink in longhand feels very freeing to me to be doing that.
Didn't you say at one point, I feel like I read that back when you were at MIT teaching, which I think was, you know, kind of at the advent of word processing and computers and people really relying on computers, that it actually physiologically changes something in your brain, the way you access language, or the creativity is different in longhand?
I think that's true. I was talking to a student about this, who was working on language and the way language changes with the use of computers, which they were, as you say, just newly examining and newly discovering things about. And he said that it does. The way you write does change when you're free to, you know, just so easily revise. And people's vocabulary increases by some measure. When they're able to just, when they don't have to use the whiteout, essentially, or retype everything. But I myself thought that I was working on my second novel at that point, and I'd done my first novel in longhand and then typed it in and so forth, but did not have a computer for it. But I just really thought it might screw around with my brain. I don't think he said it alters the way the brain works, but he did say certainly that it alters the way people write.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I also just love that you can see, you know, if you cross things out and you type another, or you handwrite another word. I mean, you can see all the ghostly images, right, of what you rejected before. So you still have those
words.
Yeah,
they're still there. And sometimes I say, you know, go back, you know, what page was that on? And I'll flip back and just use that instead of whatever it is that I got sidetracked by.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot of fluidity that I enjoy in that way.
I also want to draw attention, you had said Grace Paley's note about characters as your employees, and I'd never heard that before, but I really like that.
Yeah, it's just a revelation to me.
It is.
Deny that they're you know, someone, that they are speaking for her. I mean, they may be, but not necessarily at all. They're doing what she tells them to do.
Right. I mean, we always hear writers talk about, you know, this character has a mind of their own and they're going to do their own thing. But this idea that they're, you know, an employee in service of the story, I think is a really wonderful way to look at it, a way that I hadn't looked at it. So that's,
yeah. I don't quite get how people feel. It's not conceivable to me to let a character take over and do something. I mean, the characters exist because I want them to do what I want them to do, that I create them to be the actors in my play. I mean, to do the things I want them to do. So it's very hard for me to imagine such a fluid sense of the character that he or she would slip out of your control somehow.
Right.
But I know that many, many people talk that way about the way they work. And they, I mean, I've heard people say, people I like very much, writers say, you know, what good is it if you know where you're going? You know, it's what the point of this is, to discover things as you go along. And of course, I do discover things as I go along, but they just enrich my travels to my to my end point.
Yeah, I was going to make that point. It does sound like you're discovering things about these people as you go along, but yeah, mm-hmm. it's in service of deepening the thoughts that you already had. So that that makes sense.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that Tolstoy, you know, that Anna Karenina quote about all happy families are alike and every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Because I was thinking, you know, it's, what else is there to say about marriage? What else is there to say about infidelity? And the answer is infinite. There's always an infinite amount because there are as many marriages as there are marriages, right? And I was wondering if that was either an impediment or a exciting accelerator to this book, to think about how else can I talk about marriage? How else can I talk about infidelity? If you, you know, kind of got excited that I have a new way of talking about it, or if it was, God, there's been a lot written about it. How do I get to it from a new angle?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think through the characters. I mean, that's really what I felt, that Graham was created to be a person who had a lot of trouble being faithful. He had been pretty successful at it, but he's just a person who's terribly impulsive and very much needs other people to not just like him, but sort of love him. And so he's very vulnerable to the feelings that drive people into affairs. Plus, he had an invitation from someone that was very hard for him to turn down, a direct invitation. So, you know, I wanted to sort of be fooling around with, I guess, something that seems inevitable given the person he is and was and is to me. And to find, for Annie to find a way to think about him differently by the end, to think about what makes people who they are, what makes people do the things that hurt other people they know, what makes people who they are, essentially, will do the trick, I think.
Did it change your mind at all, writing this character? Did it kind of change your mind in any way about infidelity or marriage, or were your kind of preconceptions? I mean, as a notion,
You know, I'm always interested in, and, you know, I've written a number of books in which someone is doing something clearly not right. And, right. And to try to, by our standards anyway, and to try to, I mean, I've written a murderer in one book and really tried to give him his reasons for doing it, for killing someone. I gave it my best shot. I mean, he actually talks about it to someone else and sort of explains his feelings. And I hoped to make him, and he is convinced that he has sort of paid back for this, that he has made his life worthy enough so that he has, in a way, he's able to forgive himself for it. And then I also have, in another book, I had a much older man in his 50s seduce a teenage girl in her 15 or so. And, you know, sort of speculated about that and how, in fact, there's something rich that happens in her life because of it. It makes it changes things for her in a way that's of great value to her. And so I'm just very interested in sort of taking something that would seem, that is something that I would not like someone to do to me, for instance, and that I would not like to do to someone else, and somehow find a way to make people think of it more generously, just not be the absolute in some ways, and to do that through creating a character who seems, if not forgivable exactly, almost in a certain way inevitable, or in their particular drive towards a particular moral failing some sort of another. Right. So that's just something that I like to position myself in, next to, and to look at, and to try to not persuade people that it's okay necessarily, but it's humanly understandable.
Well, and we should add that as in all great books, the characters are all complex. And so there isn't, there's never a clear victim and a clear perpetrator. I'm not going to give anything away, but it becomes a much more complex situation as the book unfolds. Mm-hmm. And no one is entirely blameless, and no one, as all rich characters are, there's a lot going on. So yeah, to explore all of that and to make the situation sympathetic and to understand, I think there's a lot of interest in long marriages, the mm-hmm. longevity of I can't remember how long they were married, but it felt like, 30, 40 years. It's inevitably going to be complicated, right? Over that period of time. So it had all of that. I feel like I read somewhere that you struggled with this novel for a long time, that there was some point where you felt like you couldn't write it or it was somehow inaccessible to you. And I wanted to talk about that to see what the stumbling blocks may have been, or maybe I misread something.
No, I think what I've said or written somewhere is that it took 6 years, and that was partially due to just a really tough custody battle that my son was having at the time, and sort of wanting to help him out to the degree I could by just talking to him a lot, and I was very disturbed by that, and so that sort of slowed me down. But the writing part that was a problem was that I started off on the wrong foot for quite a while, so that I ended up writing more than 100 pages of starting with Annie after Graham's death, so that, and in a tone full of grief, it was first person. And it just lay flat on the page. It just didn't, you couldn't get at the characters. You could get at the grief for sure, but because it just came so rapidly at a reader, it just was not compelling, really. So I started it completely differently. I started writing third person and sitting on Graham's shoulder for the start, and then did some readjusting afterwards where it does begin with Annie in the first person, in the third person rather, but it was just a mistake, a long mistake, to start with the grievous event having occurred already and having that dominate the tone of the book. So it was just it was a bummer. It just was not interesting on the page. And so then I started over, essentially. And it was so helpful to me just to be writing about Graham, because once I got him very clearly in my own mind and on the page, the others came right along, and their feelings about him came right along, and the complexity of his relationships with his ex-wife and with his children and so forth came right along too.
I can see where that would be a compelling place to start, because you're always kind of thinking, you want to grab the reader's attention right away. And so start with the inciting event that's driving the narrative of the books, which mm-hmm. which would be his death. Right. And I think his death doesn't even really happen for, I think we get a third of the book before he...
Yeah, I think it's about 150. I haven't counted. I probably should, so I can flip that off very easily. But I think it's about 150 pages in, and the book is about 350 pages or so. So I wanted people to know him and to know his foibles, and I hoped to also find him compelling and interesting and charming in a certain way. Spend a lot of time with him, as it turned out, alive. And then, as she turns at a certain point in the book, Annie begins to pull the other characters in by talking to them, by telling them that he's died. And then we sort of move into each of their lives separately and distinctly.
Well, and I was going to say, it's so important to know who he was, because then you really feel, A, you feel the loss, and B, the second half of the book, when he's not with us, he's still driving so much of the characters' motivations and so much of their, the action of the story, even after he's dead, he's still the primary force. So you kind of have to understand what that primary force is, right? To have that narrative pull through this the second half when he's not even there and he's still looming so large over the rest of the characters.
He's there in their memories. So there are scenes where he's present as a character. They're calling up in their minds, you know, episodes with him and that sort of thing. Right. They're also calling up how horrible they feel about all of this. The loss of him.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Sue Miller. The book we are talking about is Monogamy. I've lost track of how many characters, kind of points of view, third person points of view characters there were, but there were many. There were many voices for you to access. And I always think it's interesting how much of a role minor characters play. And I don't know which characters even in here I would consider minor versus major, but I feel like minor characters really had their day in this book and they really were able to deepen and, you know, add all this complexity and texture to the rest of the narrative. And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about your minor characters and how much time you spent kind of getting to know them that may not have made it into the book and kind of how you came to know them.
Well, certainly one is their next door neighbor who is sort of slowly getting dottier and dottier over time. And her death is featured in the book too, long after Graham has died. But and she's, Karen is her name. She's sort of a Cambridge lady, but she's kind of very eccentric and sort of nutty, and they feel very connected to her and they're worried about her increasing dottiness. And then it turns out that she has left them her cat after she dies, which Annie has to take because Graham has assured her, oh, fine, we'll take the cat, of course we will. And Annie hasn't known about this, so she's the one who gets the cat. But along with the cat, she gets a whole lot of money to buy, you know, Meow Mix or something for the rest of its life, although it's quite elderly. So there's that. And I felt that, you know, it's sort of one of the things it did was to watch Graham need to be charming to her even. Mm. And also to give a cat to give a cat to Annie, as it turned out, because I needed the cat later on in the book. there's also Claire, the little girl that that Lucas and Jean, his French wife, have in the course of the book. And Lucas's struggles with his feelings that he just doesn't find her interesting or pretty or anything. He just feels very alienated from her as an infant and worries enormously about that. And it's in part thinking about his father that helps him move beyond that. Also thinking about some other things too, but that those, you know, Lucas, Claire, I mean, who actually speaks in the book a little bit and does some charming things, I thought, were, you know, that was very important to me to have Lucas go through that. And then Jean, the wife, who's present a little bit, not very much, but does an amazing, because she's very tough and she just does an amazing thing by denying the first wife, Frida, possibility of coming to the scattering of the ashes, which the children don't want her to be there. So she takes her place as a sort of pushing the action along, actually, at that point too. But I wanted them to feel surrounded, as we are in life, by people that they have to take into account, by people that they love, by people who are very important to them. Graham's partner at the bookstore, the guy who put up the money, Frida, of course, and then a friend of Annie's named Edith, who has a couple of very important talks about Graham and what he was like as they're just sitting just a few days after he's died, sitting sort of saying that they sort of expect him to walk in at any moment. How could it be that he's not there anymore? And then they sort of speculate on what he would say. So for me, at every point, those extra characters, which were central, and I wanted to give them so much life. Edith, for instance, her husband has come out as gay and left her, and she's consented to that. She feels so sorry for him. but they both still love each other very much, but their marriage has just become impossible. And that is important in the book too. Annie takes a picture of them together after they've split up that shows the pain in their relationships. And Annie wants to use it in a show and then decides she can't. And that sort of, for me, that got at some of the things that bother Annie about herself, a kind of chilliness. She sees it as connected to being a photographer, that you look at people for what you can use what you see that, you know, you can use in a picture. This would be great. And I felt actually connected to that as a writer, you know, the sort of cold-heartedness with which I rip people off, essentially, of incidents and that sort of thing. I've never created a person or tried to, it would be no fun for me to literally just use a person I know in my fiction. Actually, I had, one of the reasons I had such a hard time writing the book about my dad, the memoir, was that I couldn't make things up. I mean, I had to just use what had really happened, and I couldn't go off, you know, in my imagination, which is what I love about writing, is the sort of the way in which you just can invent and invent and invent, and how useful that is as a writer.
Well, to that point, as you're talking about Lucas and his complicated feelings about fatherhood and about Claire, his daughter, I thought that's really the power of fiction, because you get to say in a novel that you can't really say on a movie screen or in a play or maybe even in a memoir, all these complicated internal things that a lot of parents, I think, struggle with and will never say out loud, right? Because it's too daunting.
Yeah.
But you get to do that in fiction, and you get to, you know, you just get to explore the whole range of psychology that I think in any other art form is pretty inaccessible. And
it's hard to do, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to do.
And it's one of the beauties of the third person and the close third, that you just can move in and out of someone's mind. You can sort of look at them and then take a few steps forward and have them sort of think some horrible thing that they're almost not conscious of thinking, or that they push away from thinking. I mean, you can say he thought this, or he tried not to think this. There's such freedom in that particular narrative stance, I think. I'm so glad I didn't do it in the first person.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, it would have been really
we're doing a very different book.
Possible. Different book, yeah. So is that where... I'm still going back to these characters as employees. Is that where you kind of got the depth and texture in the revision process that you didn't necessarily outline Edith and Jean and some of these other characters into it, but they kind of came in writing process?
Yeah, and then I usually stop and make notes about them, so I'm sure that I understand them and what they can do and what they're like and that sort of thing. Yes, but they came in. They were a few of them unexpected guests and arrived and I made use of their presence. Yeah.
You know, the wonderful thing that I thought Lucas's wife, who is French, did for the book is she really made it feel like a uniquely American novel to me. Her personality felt in contrast to the other characters in sort of a uniquely French way. I'm saying this is an American, so I don't know, but that's kind of how it felt. And I feel like the American conception of monogamy and infidelity is very unique to America, right? I mean, we're a little bit more puritanical. We're a little bit more, I don't know.
I'm sure it's almost always painful in other cultures too, although they're even the cultures in which people can have several wives, and so that it's expected. But I think the American notion that it's deeply, deeply wrong, sinful,
right,
is I think uniquely American. Yeah, I mean, any European novel, people are just always, you know, like bunnies, they're just having affairs. I guess bunnies don't actually have affairs, but they're sleeping around. And it was interesting to me to revisit that period in time when there was this great attempt, which I think is recurring a little bit now with the whole sort of some of the discussion of polyamory and so forth. But the 60s, where there was this whole argument that, you know, you didn't own another person. You had to let that person be free. And, you know, so that the claim, any sort of notion of marital fidelity was just seen as a kind of shabby way of thinking, essentially. And that, you know, that was something Graham could really get behind for a little while.
My other favorite layer of this was the whole idea of recovered memories and the role of recovered memories and how that had all these great ripple effects through the book about how we choose to remember someone, and do we only remember traumatic things or do we also suppress happy memories? And I don't know if that was one of the original kernels that kind of drove you into the book about just, you know, kind of unpacking the role of memory and, you know.
It did. I mean, because I wanted her... her sort of revelation at the end to come from using her memories differently because of the various things that have just happened to her that she's just gone through in the kind of period of some weeks before those final scenes. So I was really speculating a lot about memory. And interestingly to me, anyway, the scene in which, you know, she's thinking of her friend and when they're molested by this man in the park, in Jackson Park, in Hyde Park, south side of Chicago. It was interesting to me that I'd used that same event, which actually happened to me and my sister. I used it in a short story very, very differently. But one of the things that has made it compelling to me over time, aside from the sort of creepiness of it all, was that my sister, we were quite a bit younger than the girls were in the story and in the novel too. My sister has no memory of it whatsoever. And for me, it's just an incredibly vivid memory from childhood. We were being very bad. We walked where we were not supposed to walk by ourselves. And look what happened to us. So that has always intrigued me, that she doesn't remember. And so that was, I think, something that started me on it. And then I was working in daycare at the time of the whole McMartin thing and the in which, you know, people were supposedly having satanic rituals, not in the basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., right. But at daycare centers and so forth. And so I was very, very conscious of that and the fact that that whole question about memory with children, especially, and the way in which children want to please you. I can remember walking into the bathroom and seeing my son, who was probably about 14 months old or something, sitting on the floor of the bathroom with all of these aspirins scattered around him on the floor. And I, of course, you know, freaked out and said, did you eat any of those? And he said, looked up at me and said, no. And I said, I wouldn't be mad if you did. I wouldn't be mad if you did. Did you eat any of those? And he said, yes. And, you know, just the wish of children they just go along with it. You know, they want to be good and they don't have yet the sense of little children of, you know, the importance
right.
to be honest. No, no, no. You don't want your mom to get really angry about something, which I guess I came across as being ready to be just freaked out.
Freaked out, yeah.
Yeah, but I think, you know, that whole aspect of things is discussed in the book, you know, the sort of impressionability of kids and their complete unreliability, as a matter of fact, when someone is questioning them closely about what might or might not have.
As so you're talking, okay.
Yeah, of memory were sort of present in my mind through the book.
Yeah, as you're talking, it's striking me again, the advantage of age in writing and how much I enjoy older writers because of this long history of stuff that's happened to them that they can draw from and bring into their fiction, you know, and mm-hmm. I mean, I now imagine that you can remember all these time periods of being a young mother, being an older mother. Now you're a mother whose son is going through his own custody battles. Now you're, mm-hmm. you know, you've gone through marriages and divorces and I mean, just the stuff that life brings makes fiction so much deeper and so much more interesting, I think so.
Yeah, there's just a lot of stuff there to use. And but it's interesting because it's just there. And then suddenly you think, you know, that's usable. I mean, that is that sort of chilly thing. Sometimes it's just my own stuff, which is fine. But I also, you know, use stuff from other people's lives, anecdotes they've told me or something. I don't use them,
yeah.
but I use their stuff sometimes.
Isn't that great? That's it.
It is great. That's why you should talk to people a lot.
A lot. Yeah. Yeah. Interview them. You talked at some point, and I thought this was kind of a useful exercise for writers when you were taking a psych class back in the day. You were doing, I think you were calling them sociograms, and you draw a circle and the person is at the middle of the circle and then you have other characters around it. Some event happens and you just start seeing how all of that event or that person ripples through these other people's lives.
Right.
And I thought, you know, if you're a visual writer, that's probably a pretty useful way to go about understanding how to put a book together. I don't know if you use
in
that.
In this way, yeah. I mean, I did feel very much, I mean, that Graham's death was this thing that, you know, caused these reactions across the circle in this character, in this character, in this character, and then their reactions in turn go at some other angle to the other characters who were set on a circle, which you do in these, so when you're constructing these sociograms. But I also like the metaphor of it. I mean, there's a kind of, it creates a sort of web that connects all these people. And that was surely part of what goes on in this book, is the is the pull and the push and the, but the connection one way or another among them, between them, around them all.
Around them all. Yeah. I mean, you really can see, if you're thinking about things in the abstract and, you know, you can imagine that infidelity is just happening to the people in the marriage. And then you come to realize how untrue that is as you start putting your head space into these other characters' points of view. I think that's probably an important exercise for writers to engage in. I also want to talk about your choice of, there's a ton of art in the book between Annie being a photographer, Grant being a bookseller, Lucas being a publisher. You know, we get a bird's eye view into this wonderful bookstore that Grant and Annie ran, Grant primarily ran. And, you know, Annie's role as a visual photographer, it kind of became kind of a, and there's another minor character, I won't give too much away, who's a writer towards the end. It kind of became a meta exercise, right, about the writer's life and the bookseller's life.
Yeah, they had nice life in some ways. And I meant that to be part of it too, that their life together was full of the pleasures of art, and you know, that their whole sort of mode of existing included lots of other people, many parties, many gatherings in which sort of the talk was of that kind of thing, and also there was dancing, there was a lot of drinking. Annie is a great cook and enjoys that, so the kind of visceral pleasures that surround them and are part of their life together meant to be one of the things that tied them to each other, and sort of the aspect of his betrayal, as it were. I mean, not to have put that all at risk in some way. Yeah. But I loved creating this Cantabrigian couple and the sort of lovely life they have in a lot of ways.
I also thought it was interesting sort of reflecting on the gender imbalance in art. You know, Annie, I think you had the observation about how women's photography, as you were studying women photographers, their photography changes based on the time of life they're experiencing, whereas men's is more constant.
Yeah, I really was struck by that. I looked at a lot of different monographs and went to a lot of different shows of different people. And it felt to me as though, I mean, I guess someone like Diane Arbus did what she did pretty singularly too, but that the women, they just were more fluid in what they tackled at. And it seemed to me to be partially dictated by what stage in their own lives they were at, with children around and domesticity and so forth, and then sort of being freed of that. There are more disparate chapters perhaps in the lives of women who have children. And also I think marriage is different for men and for women too. And I'm not going to speculate on that, but I mean, in terms of its importance and its shaping, it's the way in which it might shape a life, at least for a period of time. But I really thought, boy, the men are just noticeably more committed to a certain way of looking at the world in photography, it seems to me.
Do you feel that way in your own writing? I mean, do you feel that's true of writers as well, or is that unique to visual photography or visual arts?
I feel as though there's something very consistent about my writing over time, the sort of the way I work and what I like to sort of get out of the way I work. But I've sort of moved along, my sort of autobiographically, I suppose. And, you know, my first novel was about a woman who loses custody of a child, a young child. So a woman raising a small child who loses custody and has that great grief. And then, you know, I think I sort of have had families with older children or families with children who are gone, and what the adults sort of moving out and what that means. I've sort of gone along the track of my own life in a certain way. And I think this book may be, just as I never lost custody of a child, but I was terribly frightened of it after I was divorced. So it was sort of dealing with something that was terrifying to me in that first novel. And this too is terrifying to me, the idea of losing my partner and the solitary life that would start for me. And maybe it won't happen that way, but you know, the Freudian joke, the joke he loved or was reputed to have loved, which is when one of us dies, I think I'll move to Paris. So, it's not clear who goes first or why, but this was certainly a kind of confrontation with that for me. So,
Well, and I think that's another way this book is so relevant in the times, because I've been talking to a lot of women, specifically kind of older women who are, you know, confronting this idea of their partner getting sick, them getting sick, and and being alone, like really presently, the idea of being alone for the first time is striking people, I think, in a way that you can usually push out of your head.
Right.
And so yet another way this book is kind of talking and speaking to the times we're living through is really confronting the idea of being alone and
which is not, I mean, I knew nothing about the COVID virus when I started, launched myself into this 6 years ago, but yeah, I think it does connect to that. I think we all feel much more fragile, people of all ages, anyone with any sense, really.
Yeah.
Any adult, and the kind of possibility of something terrible happening is just very visible and all around us. And so,
at the beginning, you were alluding to some of these notes that you take when you get stuck. And I just wanted to spend our last few minutes talking about writer's block advice. I'd read you give yourself some really wonderful exercises when you're stuck that I thought could be of use to some writers. But if you're stuck in a character or you're stuck in the plot, maybe you can share some of these exercises or notes or questions that you ask of yourself to get yourself unstuck.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, actually, sometimes I just make lists. And so, you know, sort of what people's opinions are about something. And so, you know, for the character who seduces, in another book called Lost in the Forest, who seduces a very young person, I wanted him to be charming, and but not to take up too much space in the book, because he's not important, but what he does is important. So I just made a list. Duncan was of the opinion that, and then I just wrote down 6 or 7 of his opinions, which I thought would help me write again very quickly. And in the end, I just decided to use that list. And I was struck rereading Carol Shields stuff recently, where she has this sort of almost like a gimmick that she does in some books, where she'll talk about what so-and-so believed in. So-and-so believed in a clean closet, and so-and-so believed, you know, in polishing your silverware, but not too often. I mean, that kind of thing, which sort of gives you access in some way to a not very important thing about a character, but which opens the character up for you. Similarly, in a novel that had a veterinarian as its main character and the household had 3 dogs, it occurred to me at a certain point that they were just floating around, and the veterinarian would actually think of them very differently, these dogs. She would have a real sense of who they were. And I actually wrote down characteristics of each of the dog. This was the dog that one of the girls would call to when she was weeping and upset. You could, you know, her door would open and she would say, "Casey," and the dog would go up and be so nice. And others were not, you know, there were differences amongst the dogs. I never used any of that. But I think just making those, that kind of note. You know, I did it a little with Graham and the clothing that he had fallen in love with, you know, and what he liked to wear. And then I got to do his psychiatrist because of that, and talking about clothing with his psychiatrist. But I think it can help to sort of say, just ask yourself that kind of question and just make that kind of note. It gives you a sense outside of what you're wanting to do with your character, of who they are on their own, as it were. You know, someone who loves to, you know, someone who likes this kind of music. He loved so-and-so. I mean, that sort of list is enormously helpful, I think, sometimes, and can enrich your sense of things and allow you to move on with a kind of more complicated view of people.
Right. You'd also talked about the importance of feeling discomfort, that discomfort is a good sign that you're kind of onto something, you know, that either you're writing about something that frightens you or you're writing about something you're unsure about, but that you kind of have to be off your foot a little bit to feel like you're getting at the right thing in a story.
Yeah, I think that's true too, that and you can make use of that also and figure out why, and then what you want to have it, how you want to have it live on the page, essentially, if you are able to figure it out.
I have an arc here, so I don't know if this is the final cut, but there's something really interesting in the middle of the book where you are doing a lot of backstory. I think it's kind of right in the middle of the book. Cool. Doing a lot of backstory, and to delineate the backstory, you use parentheticals. So you use these parentheses when we're going back in time and then when we're not in time.
Yes. I do it a couple of times, but I forget which one you're... When I think Annie finds the woman in her, in Graham's study.
And she
goes to see Frida the next day, and that's sort of part of her memory. I mean, implicitly, it's what she's partially just haunted by as she's, although it's also giving you this information. I don't remember what page it is. Maybe I can.
I don't either, but I just wanted to draw attention to it for writers, because I think there's a lot of range that you can use punctuation in ways that you can do things with punctuation, with italics. You know, some writers don't use quotes for whatever reason, quotation marks. Yeah. But this was the first time I'd seen backstory delineated through parentheticals. I'm sure probably other writers have done it, but I just thought it was brilliant.
Oh, thank you. It occurs also when Annie is just after Grandma's died and she's had to call different people, and her, and it sort of backtracks over and over into something that has already happened with another, with, you know, previous call, or and the doctor saying certain things to her, and then it will go on in the present tense of the present situation of people hauling Graham's body down the stairs and out of the house. And so mixed in with that are these parenthetical events that have occurred a little bit earlier that day. And yes, I just didn't want to write it out straight because it seemed too, actually sort of thought her own thinking was so disjointed maybe, but that's just the way it occurred to me to do it, really.
Well, I just thought it was a very fluid way to move back and forth in time so the reader wasn't distracted. We always knew what was happening.
It is separate. You know, it was interesting because I read the audio of the book quite recently, and it was hard to do that.
Right. Right.
You know, you couldn't say parenthetically or something like that. That it was harder to indicate that in any way orally. I think I just paused a little bit as the parenthetical information was coming at me. But I just really wasn't sure how else to do it. So,
no, really smart. And again, you know, I think it showcases the full range of what novels can do that other art forms can't do. And, you know, I think just to put a note in writers' minds that you can use punctuation in really interesting, unconventional ways that serve the narrative, which is fun. No, I hadn't seen that before, and it was so easy. And we have in my writers group talk about, you know, backstory and the backstory burdening the forward momentum of the story. We have so many conversations about that. So I thought this was just a really elegant way to handle it. I don't know how if this has kind of derailed your creativity, or if you have advice for kind of sustaining creativity when there's so much noise in the outside world. If you're able to power through, or if you have...
I haven't done very well within the last year, I must say, but just as it's been an incredibly exciting time because I didn't have an agent and I wanted to switch publishers. So I was sort of stepping off a cliff, I felt, with no, and I didn't know if this book would be of interest to anyone really. So it's, you know, just having it be taken and having it, you know, doing the revisions and so forth, it's just been a wonderful experience. But so I haven't really started, I've kind of started on something new. But I need to get through this hump of talking to people about the book itself first. And then my granddaughter, who lives in Germany now, she's 12, comes over, and she managed to get out of Germany and to come here for 6 weeks this summer. She leaves the end of this week. So that's that we've had the privilege of having her here every year for 6 weeks in the summer, and then a couple of other 2-week things. But this year, it was just a matter of, you know, fretting until the last minute about what the German government would let happen with her, sort of adding to anxieties and so forth. Right. But I'm hoping to sort out the way I want to tackle this next thing, while also being conscious of my own age. Maybe I should make it a very short thing is what I'm thinking.
No.
I don't know. I generally, when I'm working, just try to stay at my desk for 3 hours. If I feel like working longer than that, I may. I'm allowed to. But and often at the end of a book, I work long, long hours a day trying to sort of make sure it's all pulled together and really, really works and is knit up tight. But yeah, there's something to be said for steadiness, for being there.
Is there any advice we should have hit on that we failed to hit on?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I'm like listening to other people's advice, but it seems to me you do kind of make your own way in a certain sense. I mean, you find out what works best for you, and that's part of it is kind of learning that about yourself and making mistakes. 100%. I mean, giving yourself a lot of room to make mistakes and start again. And I will say that one of the things that I think serves me very well in terms of knowing where I want to go is that when I've made a mistake, it's not the end of the world. I'm still going to the place I wanted to go to. It's just that wasn't the right place to start off from.
Yeah.
I feel only that I've been sidetracked, not that it's a ruinously stupid idea or something like that, because I've really thought about the idea and what I want to do with it. And I'm sort of committed to it in a way because of having really staked out a kind of path forward before I even begin.
Yeah, so some of those digressions are probably useful in the end. I mean, at least the...
Yeah, you always use something from them. Yeah, it's true.
Right. Well, you have a wonderful website, which I think is just your name, suemiller.com, where you can find out. I assume as you do events, they will be posted there.
Yeah, I haven't actually brought it up to date with Manaya. Okay. It's Sue Miller Official, because Sue Miller is
a
name that thousands and millions of people have. So that was all that was left to me, Sue Miller. but anyway, it's not quite up to date. And I guess I'll have to get on the folks at HarperCollins to try to put the various events in there, because I don't know that they have.
Well, speaking of events, you and I get to talk again. You're doing an event with Laguna Beach Books live. So we'll get a chance to chat again. So I look forward to that.
Me too.
That's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.